agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
Well, I don't have anything witty or anything. It was a rough week at Freedom Central this week, Mike. So I'm just happy to be here. We're recording early, if that that from our voices.
I just got out of my jammies. Yeah, absolutely. So it definitely. But yeah, and also I should point out that we are going to do something a little bit different this week. Normally I do the introductions that lead us into the stories, but I had a bit of a rough week. And so Jay is going to be taking that role. And we do have a bunch of things to talk about, actually, that updates on the special master and a big lawsuit against Donald Trump. I think this is number 8. I don't know. It's hard to keep track. But the Electoral Count Act, some movement on that. And of course, this week at Russia and Ukraine, some very disturbing developments there. And even more lawsuits, this time against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And we will start off with all that in just one second. Okay, Jay.
Okay,
so sorry about that. This is.
Yes, you are.
Go ahead.
This is a rough morning show. This is first story is the 11th Circuit, a three-member panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned, or should I say, ruled against a stay granted by the district court judge Eileen Cannon in the Trump special master case. What this meant was the government had applied for a limited appeal in order to remove the stay as to its continuing investigation and examination of 100 or so classified documents that had been seized from Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. The court, in a 29-page opinion, came down against Trump, saying, listen, this is a Trump essentially lacks standing to bring his claim of demanding a special master, particularly as to these documents. They were classified documents and therefore wouldn't be subject to attorney-client privilege and would be property of the United States rather than Donald Trump himself, which would alleviate some of the concerns that Judge Cannon had pointed out in her opinion, granting reasons for granting a special master. So that's what we've got. And in the other piece of this, we'll move into, Mike, is things aren't going great for Trump with the special master either. I guess we'll start with what are your, and the other thing I should point out, two of the judges on this three-judge panel were Trump appointees. He can't win even with this. Again, this is not the first time, obviously, that Trump appointed judges have ruled against Donald Trump personally. But Mike, your thoughts?
Well, it seems to me that what the 11th Circuit was saying is that, hey, we have a test here called the Ritchie test, and Judge Cannon basically just screwed it up. There's a kind of go into the, just really the basics is that this Ritchie test is this four-part test as to essentially, in this case, whether or not she should have acted in the way she did to appoint a special master. And the first part of it is whether the person can show that the government showed a callous disregard for his rights. And even Judge Cannon said no. And what the appeals court said is, hey, this is an indispensable factor. And right now, basically, based on this, we can just stop here. But they say, for the sake of completeness, we'll look at these other factors. And oh, by the way, she messes up some of these as well. And so, I mean,
as to the 100 documents, though.
Yeah, as to the 100. But yeah. Even so, and I think this is important, is if you can make this case that if the 11th Circuit is right, is that this first part of the test about callous disregard for rights is the indispensable part and without that, the other three don't matter, then this would actually potentially apply to all of these documents. And so, I mean, the government.
Correct. Yeah.
And so the government focused on these 100 because they thought this was just the slammiest of slam dunks. You could apply the logic of the 11th Circuit and say, well, if this reasoning holds, then they would be likely to win on appeal for all of this. Although I don't know that really, from a practical matter, makes a lot of sense. They were focused on, you know, these documents that are really
right. Central. To some extent, they probably wouldn't care about the other stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'm curious. It seemed to me, from my non-attorney sense, that this was a pretty big, repudiation of Judge Cannon's logic, reasoning. Just basically, it seemed to me that they were saying, you got this just so completely wrong. It's pretty impressive, and it's pretty big judicial overreach. And I wanted to get your take on that.
So, I didn't read it as quite the smackdown that you did. You know, judges get reversed and that happens. But I didn't read it as this big repudiation. I did find, I mean, to me, the more compelling piece is the standing part of this. And in order to seek, there are some technicalities about whether Trump has filed what's called a 41 motion. Or he's going to, and the record was kind of unclear, I think sort of intentionally unclear by Trump's lawyers on that about what exactly they were doing. I don't think, like I said, I don't view it as this complete smackdown. And also, as I pointed out, Judge Cannon's job is to create and preserve a record for the Court of Appeals to make a decision.
Let me ask you this, because, I mean, when I read the court, the circuit saying the court, in this case, Judge Cannon, abused their discretion. I mean, to me, that sounds pretty stark, essentially. It's not like it was a close call or anything. And that was the exact language of their ruling on this. And so,
yeah.
I mean, isn't that just basically just saying like, wow, you got it really wrong?
Yes and no. Okay. Yes, in terms of the yes, you got it really wrong. But abuse of discretion is the standard. That's the test that the appellate court is tasked at applying to Judge Cannon's decision. So, you know, in some cases, if it's a matter of law, the case goes up de novo. Which means the Court of Appeals is taking a fresh look at it as if it's before them for the first time. If it's other things, these are typically evidentiary issues, how you run the trial, and things like special master. The way it works is the trial court is given discretion to do that. And then the question on appeal is, did the trial court abuse their discretion? Now, that said, abuse of discretion is a very high standard. You get a lot of discretion.
Yeah.
Before you wander into abuse. But I think maybe it's just a matter of I see the words abuse of discretion every day, Mike.
Right.
You know, and so I think maybe sure. It comes across harsher sure. to you than it does to me. I don't read that as a put down, man, you really abused your discretion. I read it as this is the standard that we're supposed to apply. And, you know, you didn't meet that standard. That said, abuse of discretion is a pretty, I don't have the words right in front of me right now, but it is, as you say, sort of a really, you got a wide strike zone before you abuse your discretion.
And, you know,
and quite honestly, that's where I would disagree with the Court of Appeals, because I don't think it's an abuse of discretion. I think this was, I mean, you can argue right or wrong. Right. And there are plenty of cases that, you know, come up on abuse of discretion, and the trial and the appeals court will say something like, hey, look, if it was us deciding this, we probably would have gone the other way. But it was within the judge's discretion to do this. That's how I think I might have come out on that, because I think there were other factors that equitable factors that the appeals court didn't really dive into.
Well, let me ask you this,
that
then.
Perhaps they should have.
Let me ask you this then. So it seems to me that you're suggesting that the appeals court got the interpretation of the Ritchie test wrong, basically, because, again, their view was that, hey, if there's not this, you know, this blatant, callous disregard for constitutional rights, then we can't just go ahead and say there's got to be a special master. You have to return this stuff that was legally obtained through a search to the person who's asking for it back. And by the way, of course, with these documents, even, you know, Donald Trump isn't asking for them back, but that's a whole other story. And so it seems to me you're saying that the appeals court is misinterpreting this test, essentially.
I would fall on the line of the Ritchie test is a four-factor test and not a each factor is indispensable.
Well, yeah, and there's only one factor that's indispensable, they said, just that
right.
first
well,
one.
Well, that's according to the court here. And I'm not... I would have to do some digging, to do some more research to get to that point as to whether that is always indispensable or not. Look, they're the Court of Appeals, and I'm sure they did the digging and did some research into it. Likewise, I would imagine that Judge Cannon did as well. So, that's kind of a question I'm not, sure. I can't give you a firm answer on. But that's my issue is and in any case if it's a discretionary call, I would have given the trial judge the wider strike zone, simply because one, it's when you're talking about privilege issues, it's again bells that can't be unrung, and the national importance of this. And I think the real importance that whatever happens is perceived to be fair and above board.
Right. And this goes back to, you know, there were some folks on the Facebook, our Facebook group last week, suggesting that, you know, you are taking this position because just like Judge Cannon, you are essentially, you know, a spineless sycophant for Donald Trump and Trumpism. And
Donald Trump never appointed me to anything.
Yeah, you know. And, well, you're hoping, you know, in the next administration.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be useful for you to kind of talk about, you know, not how you think potentially you can see Judge Cannon's actions and your reaction, actually, not in terms of, well, you're trying to make a ruling that's more favorable to Donald Trump.
Yeah, this is not about, Team Trump or not Team Trump. Alan Dershowitz, of all people, had a really good op-ed a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal on this, where he actually came out saying, you know, Judge Cannon did the right thing. And this is Alan Dershowitz, who is not a man of the right by any means. And he sort of made the same argument that I made, but more eloquently. And that is the federal government has vast and awesome powers. And when those powers are subject to abuse, they have been abused many times in the past. And one of the biggest abuses that our framers feared that has been an abuse that we have rifled out across the world is the use of the criminal justice system to achieve political means, to shut down your political enemies, to lock them up. And I think that's a big problem, and that's one of the chief injustices that our Constitution was set up to guard against. I mean, if you look at the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment, I mean that's 40% of your First Amendments. You know, they're all geared towards protection of people from the federal police, essentially. And again, remember when it was ratified, it was applied only to the federal government. And to me, that is a big issue because for look, the people who framed this, they were really concerned about getting charged with treason and drawn and quartered, for disagreeing with the king. So to me, that is a tremendous principle that you need to defend, and it doesn't matter who the defendant is. Donald Trump, let's stipulate, is a horrible person. But it's exactly horrible people who need those that defense, because you know, people who are popular, exposing or espousing popular views, don't tend to be the subject of a, you know, criminal prosecution. And again, I'm not saying that's not to say the criminal prosecution isn't warranted, or that he might not be guilty or might not be, you know, should be convicted in the end. But what I'm saying is, when you have those factors, when you're looking at the government prosecuting a major political figure, I would err on the side of more caution, moving more slowly to ensure that all the safeguards are present, one, to protect the defendant against government overreach, and two, to assure the public that this is not a banana republic. And I think that's, you know, that's why I think if there is a lull in the you know, moving forward with the prosecution, I don't see that as big a problem as the government did. And the appeals court sort of pointed and say, well, the government has a really compelling interest in continuing this investigation. And that's, again, that's where I sort of disagree, even with those two Trump appointees.
Let me just say, it seems that you're a lot more comfortable with judicial activism in this particular instance than typically you are, because I understand saying, well, in close calls, maybe erring on the side for the reasons that you discuss, and I agree with you there. But it's one thing to say, well, let's have a generous strike zone. It's another thing to say, well, just throw the ball wherever you want. You know, as long as it doesn't hit the backstop, we're going to call it a strike because you're a really good pitcher and, you know, the batter's a lot smaller. So, and it seems to me you can make the argument that just like, you know, the appeals court said, it's like, hey, traditionally, we defer to the government when it comes to national security classified documents. And I think people could hear what you're saying and say, well, you know, Donald Trump, because he was Donald Trump and because the government is corrupt, he should get a pass, basically. And unless it's like totally,
that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, okay, because people are going to hear that, I think. And
people will always hear what
I'm hearing
what I say.
I guess I'm trying to find limiting principles here. And it sounds to me like what you're saying almost is that if there's any way possible to err on the side of Donald Trump here, that's what you should do. And I don't know. I feel really uncomfortable with that, especially that the person doing the airing would be a federal judge appointed by Donald Trump. You talk about legitimacy and you know, concerns of the public that this is a fair process. I think people can legitimately say, well, wait a second. This person that Donald Trump appointed after he lost the election makes this kind of hinky sounding ruling that gets maybe my viewing smacked down by the appeals court. That smells a little bit off.
Well, I would start with where we are here about what Judge Cannon, the suit that was brought before her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I would like a special master appointed to review these documents before they're handed over to the government to screen for privilege.
They already had been, right? Of course. I mean, they had been and they'd been screened.
They had been screened for privilege by the government.
Yeah.
And there's evidence, as Trump lawyers pointed out and Judge Cannon pointed out in her opinion, that some pieces of that screen were ineffective in that there were some documents that should have been screened out for privilege that did end up with the investigative team. So and the appeals court notes that.
Mm-hmm.
So look, if you're saying, yes, this is a big deal. It's the first time ever we've had the federal government raid the home of a former president in seeking to prosecute a former president, indict and prosecute. Because let's be clear, that's what's happening. It's not an investigation. They're going to indict him. They're going to prosecute him.
Wait a second.
No,
so, you know, well, they may, they I think you're jumping the gun, but go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead. I disagree with you on that.
So at this point, let's put it this way. If you're Trump's lawyers, that is your assumption.
Sure. Okay. That's fair. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. People don't execute search warrants on other citizens just to say, we're just kind of looking around. We're just, you know, they do it because they have sworn in court that they believe there's probable cause that a crime has been committed by the person they're searching.
But in this case, Jay, I mean, in this case, if because Donald Trump is, you know, in the unusual position of being the former president who had access to documents of the highest classification, the only crime might just be that, hey, there are these things that are really sensitive and we want them back. And so you can envision a scenario in which the government says, well, okay, we have to get these back. We've been, in the words of former Attorney General Bill Barr, we've been jerked around for a year. These are important documents and we're going to execute this warrant to get them back. And if there's more, you know, on top of that, okay, but we don't necessarily know that there's more. And I'm a little more, I understand where if I'm one of Donald Trump's attorneys, poor bastard, you know, I certainly want to have to work under that assumption. But I think the government might find that there may be more, but it may be more along the lines of, well, stuff we think we know, but we can't really prove in court. And so we're not going to go ahead. So I think in that sense, I'm a lot less certain that the government felt, well, we're doing this because we are intending to indict and prosecute him. Whereas I think it's more likely a case of we're doing this because, hey, we have these, he has these documents and we need to get them back. And if this leads to enough information to indict and prosecute, certainly we'll do that, but that's not necessarily a foregone conclusion.
I think it is a foregone conclusion. You don't think they're going to indict?
Well, I'm saying, I guess foregone conclusion to me suggests that, hey, you know what, we're going to indict. We don't care what the evidence is, but and I'm hoping you're not saying that the government has just decided that they are going to indict Donald Trump no matter what. Basically, we don't care about the evidence. I mean, are you saying that?
I'm saying that the government will do whatever it can to come up with evidence on which it can indict Donald Trump.
So that's a witch hunt. Okay. I mean, so you're saying,
well, as he's been saying, yeah.
Wow.
And I think there's evidence for that. I mean,
wow.
Would the government falsify an intelligence report and lie to a secret court in order to get a warrant to spy on Donald Trump?
I would say that there are individuals in the government who absolutely do that all the time, whether it's Donald Trump or, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are certain individuals who do that all the time, but yeah, there are cases like that. But the larger argument saying that there is some sort of large-scale, full-fledged government conspiracy to convict or to indict Donald Trump.
It's not a conspiracy. It's,
well, sure it is.
We're the Justice Department. We're gonna convict this guy.
I originally thought that we were gonna, you know, you were gonna suggest how you were not really kind of into that kind of conspiracy Trumpist sort of camp. But I think you've just plopped yourself firmly into the middle of it, because from what you've just said, it's like, hey, the government doesn't care what the evidence is. They're going to do whatever they can, and they're going to go ahead and railroad this guy, even if he's a horrible guy, because he's a political opponent. That's what it sounds like to me.
No. I'm not suggesting that the government would do so without the evidence. I think they could come up with evidence.
When you say come up with the evidence, do you mean find evidence, or do you mean
find it in boxes at Mar-a-Lago?
Okay. Yeah. So you're not saying like find in the way of like when Donald Trump said that in Georgia,
the
votes.
I'm not suggesting that the government has falsified evidence in this case, although I am saying that the government has falsified evidence to get warrants in the past.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Specifically regarding Donald Trump.
Yeah, and that's something that Trump's attorneys...
But they don't do that anymore.
I'm not saying that. So, of course, that's always something that, you know, that Trump's attorneys can raise as a question if they have evidence of it. And in fact, they have attempted to do that,
right? The special master has asked that.
Yeah, and the special master has said, well, wait a second. You need to actually show some evidence of that. You just can't make wild claims about stuff being created, basically, about stuff being planted. And to this point, Trump's attorneys, it kind of reminds me of the election dispute after 2020, saying evidence. Can't we just say this and have you accept it, basically? Because it seems to me that the crux of Trump's defense here is basically not fair. They're out to get me. So therefore, everything they do is, you know, bad and wrong that involves me. It's not a great legal defense, but it certainly may be a better.
No, it's not.
Defense.
It's not at all.
Yeah.
And what I'm suggesting is Trump well could be guilty of committing crimes. It could be that he ought to be indicted for committing crimes. It could be he ought to be prosecuted and locked up even for committing these crimes. What I'm suggesting is when you have a situation like you have here, where the government has cheated, falsified, you've had senior FBI officials talking about the plan B, right, in case he gets elected to derail him. You have actual, firm, uncontrovertible documentary evidence that they took steps well outside of what they were allowed to do, well outside of what the normal course was to in order to get Donald Trump. There is before the public evidence that the FBI has also taken unusual steps to not prosecute folks in the Democratic Party or related to the Democratic Party.
Oh, wait, hold on. This is the kind of thing where I have to stop you, because this is an instance where people are going to say, wait a second. Now, that sounds like a pretty wild claim. And to be fair, sure. I wasn't prepared for this. And are you talking about, who are you talking about actually here? So we need to.
Hillary Clinton.
Okay. Now, I think that's completely inaccurate. In fact, I think you can make the opposite case.
How so?
I think you can make the opposite case that, in fact, it was the FBI announcing the investigation investigation about Hillary Clinton that cost her the presidency in the first place. And secondly, I would say you're conflating these two things, I think, is completely inappropriate. If you're talking about this as a matter of public perception, at least especially on the right, that's one thing. But what I'm saying is that as a matter of fact, as a matter of law, these are two very, very different circumstances. And so I want to make that distinction very, very clear before we move on.
So let's say we get a question from an astute listener who comes up and says, Mike, can you tell me why Hillary Clinton wasn't prosecuted for mishandling government documents, but Donald Trump is?
Well, he hasn't been prosecuted. Well, number one, Donald Trump hasn't been prosecuted yet. There's just like with the Clinton situation, there's an investigation, number one. Number two, we have, I think, the in terms of the evidence, there are differences, big differences. And I would say that my...
What are those differences?
Well, you know, you put me on the spot and I have to go back
That's not fair.
But I would say my default position is that, well, if somebody is not prosecuted, it is because there isn't the evidence to prosecute them, because prosecutors love big cases, love high-profile career-making cases. And so I'm going to start from the default assumption that the reason why somebody isn't being indicted is because there isn't the evidence to indict them, as opposed to, you know, these bizarre fever swamp of the right sort of conspiracy theories that, well, they're not indicted.
And do you think prosecuting Hillary Clinton would make someone's career? Good Lord.
Absolutely.
In the FBI?
Absolutely.
Oh, boy.
Absolutely. I mean.
So what I'm trying to get at, all right?
Sure.
And again, it's a weird thing of any time I say, hey, civil liberties, Fourth Amendment and due process, everybody's, you know, oh, my God, you're defending Trump and this is a fever swamp, this is a conspiracy. No, what I'm saying is there is a perception in the American public. It's a very, very strong perception. It's not based on, and it's not a QAnon conspiracy. It is people heard Robert Mueller get up and say, or James Comey get up and say, listen, no reasonable prosecutor would bring this kind of case. Now, the FBI has never made those statements before, right? It's never come out of the FBI before. It's always come out of the prosecutor. There was the meeting the week before, where the sitting attorney general met with the former president and husband of the subject of the investigation, held up an airplane on a tarmac. President Obama, to share photos of grandchildren and all that. That perception is out there. There is the Hunter Biden laptop where The media squelched the story, saying, "Well, it can't be confirmed, can't be confirmed, can't be confirmed." The FBI had it all along. The FBI, a member, part of the FBI, went along with the story of, "Well, this is Russian disinformation," even when they knew it wasn't true. Now, you can argue if you want to say, "Well, that's not exactly how it happened. That's not the facts. That's, you know, they were supposed to keep quiet." Sure, but there is a tremendous perception in the country that there are two standards of justice, depending on what party you belong to. And my point is, Donald Trump may be guilty as hell, but if you want to have a country that does not start devolving into the banana republic, you need to follow every single bit by the book. It needs to be Joe Friday and not Roscoe Coltrane running the investigation. And my argument, and this is the same argument that Dershowitz made, is that, look, There is very little to be gained from the government's prosecutorial angle, at least as far as we can tell, right? That they need this stuff right away. But I think there's a lot to be lost if the narrative that this is a witch hunt and that, you know, they're skipping steps, that they're not giving him the rights that he ought to have.
I see what you're saying.
I think that's a big problem.
I see what you're saying, and I agree in principle with all of it, but I would say a couple of points. Number one, this isn't the belief in America in general. It's particularly a belief in a certain part of America, and let's be clear, in conservative America, right? So there are, you know, there are more than half the country doesn't necessarily believe that. And I just want to make sure we make that distinction clear. But yeah, I mean, you're certainly right that you don't want to. I mean, there are people who are very invested, starting with Donald Trump himself, in saying that this is the greatest witch hunt in American history. And definitely you don't want to do anything that would make it easier to make that argument. And so in that sense, I do agree with you.
And I'm going to throw this out. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. According to the New York Times, they report that President Biden has, in personal conversation, said he absolutely wants to see Trump indicted. Now, you can dispute the reporting, all right? But look, this isn't the Federalist. This isn't Breitbart. This is the New York Times.
But I think if you take a look at the context of those quotes, even, I mean, you say it's not on the record.
He wanted him prosecuted for January 6th.
Right. And I think that doesn't seem bizarre to me. I mean, certainly if I would hope that any president would say, hey, if there's somebody who is guilty of crimes, we want them to have a.
No. But there's a difference between saying if there's someone guilty of crimes, I want to see them prosecuted. And I would like to see this guy prosecuted.
Well, but okay. So number one, we're talking about something that's not a public statement of the president. That's from sources, and so I guess
it goes to perception. And this is not out of the right wing media fever swamps. This is from the New York Times.
I guess what would you have him say if he believes that the former president is guilty of various crimes? And if he's not speaking on the record, he's saying to somebody, you know, in the White House, saying like, yeah, I think, you know, he should. It seems to me he's guilty of this. And if a court believes the same thing, well, yeah, he should be prosecuted. Wouldn't it be weird for the, you know, the head of the executive branch?
Let me back up. I mean, maybe I should be more clear about what he's saying. It's not just him musing around the office. Boy, if that guy did it, I sure hope he gets prosecuted. It's telling your attorney general and your Justice Department, I would like to see this guy prosecuted.
Well, I see. I
that's a difference. You can disagree about the facts. Was that said? Was it? I don't know. As they say, all I know is what I read in the New York Times.
Yeah, but I mean,
but
see,
that perception is out there.
Sure, and it's out there because there are a whole bunch of people on the right, the conservative media complex,
Times,
that are just really interested in pushing this story. And so, yeah, they're going to create.
Well, don't you think that maybe if let's say it is true, the Tongue of the Times thought it was newsworthy. They didn't think Hunter Biden's laptop was.
Well, and again, hold on. Stop right there, because the Times has done a bunch of reporting on the Biden laptop story, both before and after the revelation. I don't think we're really in a position to get back into this.
My point is, wouldn't that be one of the biggest stories of the decade, if not the century?
What's that?
President asks Justice Department to prosecute
absolutely.
Political rival.
Absolutely. It sure would be. But again, you know, we have Donald Trump leading chance of lock her up, right? So I mean, we've already seen this story, certainly. And so
But let's rewind to that though. During those chants, and you can look at the video. What Donald Trump did after the crowds are saying lock her up is he quieted him down and he says, no, we're not going to lock her up. We're going to beat her in the election.
At least at one point. Now, and this is, if I were kind of going along the same lines, you'd say, well, no, he's said stuff before and it's made it very clear that he's interested in prosecuting his political opponents. So what I'm suggesting is
but let's look at the record. Did he?
Did he what?
Prosecute his political opponents.
Well, he served. You know what? This is devolving into kind of a whataboutism sort of argument, and I don't know if it's very, very profitable because I personally just am not. I did not prepare for this, and I'm not going to.
No, neither
just
did
pop
I. But
off,
I'm,
out of
I'm,
my.
I'm trying to explain why I am defend why I think on this procedural ruling that the district court was within its rights or with at least within its jurisdiction or within its discretion to say we should have a special master.
Yeah, I'm glad you pull it back to that.
That's what I'm trying to argue. And the point I'm trying to get at is there is a lot of reasons. Now you may disagree with them, but that most of America,
most of conservative
America,
there you go.
Let's put it this way. A lot of America, perhaps 50%, perhaps more, sees the Justice Department, sees this as a persecution of their political hero.
Okay.
That's bad for democracy.
On that note, let's just take a quick break because I have some thoughts about that. I just want to get right back to that. Okay. So I guess, Jay, what I wanted to kind of bring this back to is I understand what you're saying, and I do not, to be clear, I do not disagree with you about the perception argument. Certainly on the right, there is that perception, and I'm not denying that at all. And so given that, again, I agree with you that it's important, given the high stakes here, that everything be done in such a way, like you said, more Joe Friday than Roscoe P. Coltrane, certainly. And I think that's a great and important and perfectly right argument. I guess where we sort of part ways is that I think that it's one thing to say, well, the government has done questionable things in the past. Certainly it has. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we create a new set of rules for someone, or certain judges do that to kind of adjust for that sort of thing. And that's the perception for a lot of folks on the left. So you talk about these negative perceptions on the right. Well, there's the same thing on the left, pointing to folks like, you know, Bill Barr when he was Attorney General, or Judge Cannon here, and say, well, look, it seems like they're doing the same stuff that the right's accusing the government of doing. And so it seems to me that's a reasonable argument as well. And one that, you know,
I get that. And I think some of that is because of media framing as to how they're looking at this. Again, going back to what Judge Cannon ruled on, right, was a request that, listen, I'm concerned about the federal government investigating me because they have a history of us not getting along. And because they've also missed some things that they should have screened out that they didn't. And we think it would be better if we had someone appointed, agreed upon by the parties, who could screen this stuff for privilege before it goes to the federal government. That's the procedural thing that we're fighting about. This isn't about, is Donald Trump guilty?
Right.
The horrible person is Donald Trump, the second coming, and all those other things. This, it's a narrow procedural sort of ruling. My point is, I think it is, it's not a matter of the court making up new rules for Donald Trump. It's a matter of the court exercising its discretion in the course of an investigation when they've got someone who comes before them and says, listen, I think there's an issue here. The trial court, she made her decision. It went to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals made its decision.
I mean, you can understand, I would expect, the view on the left that this abuse of discretion, as the appeals court called it, is the result of, well, the so-called, you know, Trump uses it himself, right? A Trump judge, basically a very Trumpy Trump judge, sort of bending the rules in favor of Donald Trump. I mean, I'm not saying that's the reality, but you can certainly understand that perception.
Oh, that's certainly what they're arguing.
Yeah.
And I think that's shameful.
Shameful? I mean, but you're making the same argument.
No. How am I making
you're making the argument just, you're making the same argument about the FBI that this you can make this argument that reasonable to argue that the government is corrupt and out to get Donald Trump. I don't understand why you can't at least make the perceptual argument that it does seem at least a little hinky that a judge who was appointed by Donald Trump at the very end of his administration has ruled in such a way that even the Donald Trump judge majority appeals court say is an abuse of discretion. And so when I say, well, a reasonable person could look at that and say, well, why would she do that? Maybe she's a little beholden to Trump or a little biased. You say that's shameful?
I say that the media pushing that narrative is shameful. And the reason is judges disagree. Sure. Keep in mind, I said it was shameful when the right-wing media went after the magistrate judge who issued the warrant.
Sure.
And in my position, and this is, you know, listen, where I stand on a whole bunch of things, one can't just attack the judiciary and impute motives without some sort of evidence. And if the evidence is only, well, she was appointed by Trump, well, that's not good evidence because everyone's appointed by someone. And that troubles me, this idea that it's a Trump judge is going to rule this way. Well, you just had a situation where you had two Trump judges who ruled against him.
Well, that's my point, right? I mean, that's my point. It's not just saying.
So therefore, the Trump judge that ruled for him must be somehow.
Well, just like how every FBI agent, in fact, the vast majority of FBI agents are good and decent folks who would not break the law to get.
Agreed. Yes.
You can say that, well, I am certain that the vast majority of federal judges are people of sterling integrity and high standards who would not do that. But certainly you would agree that there are occasional judges who do things that are not according to Hoyle. And sure. Given, I'm not saying that Judge Cannon is one of those judges, but I'm saying that given what we've seen, it's not unreasonable for someone to say, wow, this seems a little suspicious. That's all I'm saying. I'm talking about, just like you were talking about, that distinction between perception and what the reality might be.
It is not perhaps unreasonable, again, given the information that they're given. I think it is erroneous, though.
Gotcha. Okay. And that I can understand that. Let me ask you something.
And again, my point is my jeremiads against the FBI are based on actual evidence and actual stuff that's happened,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
That is no longer in dispute. The argument against Judge Cannon is purely conjectural that, well, because Trump appointed her, you know, she's going to bend the law. And again, I don't see this as bending the law or creating new rules. It's sort of she was asked to apply her discretion to an issue. She did. It went to the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals said you erred.
Right.
And that's the way the situation works. Right. It's, you know, so I'm not.
Yeah.
The
system worked basically in the end. Yeah.
So, and you can agree or disagree with what the Court of Appeals or what Judge Cannon did, but I'm not assigning, you know, bad motives to either.
Yeah. Got it. And neither am I. We're both, I think, talking about how people might perceive things in both the left and the right. And understandably, you're a little more in tune with the right's perception of things. And I'm a little more attuned with the left, perhaps. But, you mentioned earlier the special master thing. And that was one of the things this week, right, that Judge Deary said is he asked Trump's lawyers, well, why haven't you provided any evidence that the former president declassified these documents? And, you can't just say, well, they were declassified. And this week, right, Donald Trump, in an interview with Sean Hannity, said basically that you can just think about declassifying documents, and apparently they become declassified. And Judge Deary's view, right, you can't have your cake and eat it. You have to come to court with some proof. And like I said, to me, obviously, I know, Jay, you do not agree with Donald Trump that, well, there can be a process, but there doesn't have to be. You find that to be just wrong on the facts. But
I think there is I think someone could make a good faith argument on the president being able to hold certain records under the Presidential Records Act and examine them. I think you can say, well, there's a good argument the president has the constitutional authority to declassify records and therefore can sort of create the process by which they are declassified, and whether or not they have to go to the formal process. I think that's a question you can argue about. I don't think you can get it. Yeah, I don't think you can get it just by saying, I don't think you can just mentally declassify things.
Okay.
I am confident on that point of the law, that the president cannot just think that they are declassified and therefore to classify them.
Right.
I think there has to be some actual presidential action. Now, again, that action could come in different forms, and that's the point. I think we could argue about, right, whether he.
But there needs to be at some point, yeah. And I see what you're saying. But even if
does it mean to be the president can write on the back of an envelope these records are declassified, or yeah, does it have to go through a bureaucratic process? I might argue with constitutionally the former. But the fact is, we don't even have that.
Exactly. I mean, there has to be, yeah, even if you want to make the argument that, and I think it would be a stretch, that a president can have a standing order declassifying documents. And I think there's federal law that would point otherwise, but I think at least there would have to be a record of that standing order somewhere, and there's not even right. not even that basically. And so, right.
And as you point out, yeah, there I would say the president does have some constitutional authority to do that, but that can be limited. There's other statutes
right
that could hem in that authority.
Yeah. Because just because you're president doesn't mean you can do whatever you want with documents, essentially.
Yeah.
I think there's an important distinction here, though, because people hear this stuff, people, especially anyone who kind of knows the law, right, would say, well, of course, this is just ridiculous. And why is he saying ridiculous thing? I mean, that interview snippet with Hannity was widely, shared and mocked by a lot of folks. But I think that misses a point. Because this reminds me very much of the election arguments, right, where you had Rudy Giuliani and various other, released the crackhead sort of folks, whatever, making these crazy arguments. And in court, of course, they were just being laughed out of court. But the whole point to me, it seems like if you look at these as legal arguments, yeah, they're almost non-existent. But Donald Trump doesn't care, I don't think, so much about legal arguments. These are much better political arguments than legal arguments. And I think for a lot of people saying, hear Donald Trump say, well, I'm the president and I can declassify military documents. So, yeah, okay. And for most people, that's where it kind of begins and ends. So I really think that while he's making ludicrous and laughable legal arguments, he's not actually even doing that, right? He's making political arguments. And I think those political arguments are actually landing with exactly the people he wants them to land with.
So there's the old, legal aphorism, right? That the law is on your side, argue the law. If the facts are on your side, argue the facts. If neither, pound the table.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, I think that's what it is. It's table pounding.
Yeah. And it's very successful. I mean, the more, that's the thing. He's in a.
He doesn't have any choice. He doesn't, what are his other options?
But he's really, but my point is this plays to a strength of Donald Trump. He's awesome at playing the aggrieved victim, right? I mean, you know, I don't think there's ever been a billionaire, or who knows if he's actually a billionaire, we'll maybe get to that, but who's been more aggrieved and been more attacked. And it's just such a, you know, a sad, just gone after person, right? He's great at that. And the people who support him love that sort of thing. And so this actually, I would argue, just strengthens him politically, even if it hurts him legally. And my read of this whole situation, and we'll probably later in the show, in a minute here, get to that New York lawsuit. I think that this is great for Donald Trump politically. I don't see him ever getting convicted of anything. And I just think this makes him so much stronger politically, because the more things he can point to, even if it's, you know, hey, government should be going against him because he's breaking the law potentially. Well, he can just say, see, this is the witch hunt against me. And so it is the strategy that plays right in Donald Trump's hands, I think.
Right. And again, not to bring back Star Tops, but the way to combat that is to be meticulous about the procedure.
See, that's why I don't think that matters. I think I agree with you. That can help at the margins, but with the people,
it can take away the argument of it's a witch hunt. They're out to get me.
But it doesn't.
Me.
Well, no, it doesn't.
Really, but they appointed a special master for you. But they did.
But it doesn't.
It was a Reagan appointee who's the special master. Yeah. Well, okay.
But it does. See, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't take away that
argument. The true believers are not. You're not going to pull them away. But there are, I think it makes a difference.
There are tens of millions of those true believers, and they are people now who, like with the election denial, are people who, in many instances, have been voted into offices where they are going to have some sort of role in deciding, vote counting in 2022 and possibly 2024 if they're reelected to those positions. So this kind of I understand what you're saying to sort of reasonable people who aren't kind of, you know, off the reservation. Yeah, but we have a lot of those people who actually now are not just in the electorate, but people who are in government who are espousing these beliefs. And the facts don't matter. So, all right.
So turning to our next story.
Yeah.
Related.
Yeah.
And the continuing persecution of Donald J. Trump. New York Attorney General Letitia James has brought a civil lawsuit against Trump and the Trump Organization for fraud relating to property taxation and the miscalculation or intentional misstatement of property sizes and values. This is following up on what had been sort of a long-running investigation by the New York Attorney General's office against said Donald J. Trump. So, Mike, your thoughts? And again, there's some crossover here as far as what happens next.
This is going to sound like feel like whiplash, I imagine, to some listeners. But boy, I have a bad feeling about
Letitia James is out of control.
Well, you know, I mean, I got to say this feels kind of hinky to me. Maybe it's that. I'm trying to think through this because it seems to me that I have no doubt, it would not surprise me at all that Donald Trump wildly inflated valuations of stuff, because that's Donald Trump. Okay. That's his whole career. But as I understand how this has worked out, this is the sort of thing that would be incredibly difficult to prove in court, number one, because property valuations can be subjective. And also, that none of the banks, as far as I can tell, are complaining about this. So I'm unclear as to the harm that's been suffered.
Who's the victim?
And also that, from what I understand, the financial statements in which he was applying for these loans and other things typically had a disclaimer saying that, oh, by the way, this is just what we're saying, and we haven't had these independently audited. So if you're Deutsche Bank or someone, and you know, you could say, well, we want an independent assessment, and they could have done that, and they didn't. And so I'm not saying that he didn't potentially break the law here. But what I'm saying
is, to be clear, this is a civil prosecution.
Right. Yeah. And they to point out that, you know, there was earlier in New York State, a criminal investigation had been started, but it was ended when they thought, wow, we just don't have much here. So this to me really feels like, you know, this is what feels to me like kind of politically motivated prosecution of Donald Trump, because a
politically motivated law enforcement officer.
Yeah.
Going after Donald Trump.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I can believe that he may have broken
the fever swamps, Mike.
Well, you know, but I can believe that he'd broken the law here. You know, I'm trying to understand this because it seems to me that just as a matter of law, this would be incredibly difficult to prove because you have to prove intent to deceive. And I don't see that happening. So I don't see there being a plausibility of getting conviction. So why do you waste?
We should be clear. It's not, it wouldn't necessarily be a conviction. It would be
a ruling.
Finding of liability.
Right. Yeah. And so given what she wants, right, $250 million and Trump's and his three kids never to be able to be a director of a business in New York, this to me just reeks of political grandstanding, and I feel conflicted because
was this, Mike, like 10 minutes ago?
No, because it's an entirely different matter. I'm not just, you know, I don't think it's right to say, well, everyone is against Donald Trump and league against him and is wrongfully accusing him and things going after him. I think it's important to take these things on a case-by-case basis.
Oh, fair enough. That's a good point.
This is a very different matter than that. And on this, I mean, you know, my initial inclination is if someone says to me, Donald Trump is lying about something, like, yeah, that sounds about right to me. That's Donald Trump. He lies like hell. But here, I'm trying to understand how you justify using the resources, vast resources of the state in an instance where I don't see how it's possible or likely to get that result. So what's she doing? I don't know, but boy, this just feels off to me, I got to say. So that's kind of, you know, and I'm thinking, well, what is it? Maybe she's, you know, you investigate someone for years and years and you get that kind of Moby Dick syndrome, right? Where you're like, oh my God, I can't let this person get away. I think that's a natural human inclination. Politically, I don't know. James isn't all that young. She's 63. It's not like there's an open New York Senate seat. I mean, Schumer and Gillibrand are pretty firmly ensconced there, right? And none of them are looking to exit. So I don't know what's going on here, but I got to say this, if I were knowing what I know, and granted, James knows a lot more than I do and the facts of this, I would not have done this. This feels like political grandstanding, and I am not a fan.
Right. I think that's exactly what it is. I think it is just you pick your target and you try to go after them. I'm a little at a loss for words after our conversation because I'm sort of, well, this is kind of what I'm talking about. But this is where you get that perception that there are people out there who are just out to get Donald Trump. And I think the reason she's doing it is, one, it gets her name in the paper. Two, it pleases her constituents. It is part of a platform, particularly of the far left, of what do we stand for? Well, we stand for prosecuting Donald Trump in any way, in any court, any time that we can.
But I don't know. I don't necessarily think this is about Trump per se. I mean, you can make that. If you're trying to make an argument that she's acting in good faith, you can certainly say you can certainly say that there are laws against giving false, regardless of whether or not the banks are complicit in it or not. There are still laws against this sort of thing, and it's
but it is you mentioned it's a question of resources.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so,
if it is a crime that no one is complaining about.
Yeah. And not only that, but I would argue that if you are concerned about the influence and the power of Donald Trump, this is exactly what you wouldn't want to do. Because, you know, as Frank Luntz said this last week, he's a Republican consultant who's been around since the Reagan era, I think. He said, you know, the more Trump's attacked, the higher he climbs among Republicans. He knows how to play the victim card perfectly. And so you're just giving this to him. This is, I think, a prosecution, not a prosecution, but an action that New York State is not going to win. I think there's a very low likelihood. And so what does this do in the end? It just gives more ammunition and helps to, you know, advance this argument of Donald Trump's, which is, if you're concerned about Donald Trump coming back into power and doing awful things, this is exactly what you shouldn't be doing, I would say. And so I feel like it's self-defeating, which is why, another reason why I'm very much against it.
So on that, I mean, I think if you're thinking in the more 3D chess or even just 2D chess, the other argument that you would make is, if I'm a Democrat running for office, I want Donald Trump splashed across the news all the time, 24/7, as much as possible. And this achieves that result.
Yeah, but I wonder, so, I see what you're saying. But I wonder how much that ties to the midterms. If he were running for president or announced candidate, if we were talking about, but I think that's, even if it is a 3D chess sort of argument, I think it's a pretty bad strategy, I would say.
Well, it's a bad strategy. I mean, but if you look also in this phenomenon, and I don't know whether we talked about this before earlier this summer, of the phenomenon of Democratic money being funneled into, pushed, fire hosed into Republican primaries to elect the Donald Trump candidate, right?
I wouldn't say fire hosed. It's not really a fire, but okay. But yes,
in some cases it was. In some cases, there were candidates who got Republican primary candidates endorsed by Donald Trump, who the vast majority of their funding came from,
right,
the Democratic Party. The reason being that they would, get someone who is so extreme in the primary that he or she would be easily beatable in the general. I can see this, part of, and then you tie that person to Donald Trump. So this person, who we just spent the money to get elected, in the primary, is a horrible opponent of democracy, and he's buddies with that real estate crook, Donald Trump.
But more than that, I think, and in that case, you can say, well, this is the person who was an election denier, who has some pretty wild. So, I mean,
I mean, there's a whole menu of options to go with. And I mean, you're just kind of tacking real estate crook on at the end. But,
And of course, that
sells better with some people. Yeah.
And that is a strategy that has, that has certain potential risks, right? Because I remember that being when you and I were in the early days of the show, and I was like, oh man, we can't, on the left, we can't, we're really hoping Donald Trump's the nominee because, boy, we're going to beat him like a drum. And that did not work out very well, So there is a risk factor here, though it's admittedly lesser risk when you're talking about, congressional seats as opposed to president of the United States, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, there's just fewer moving parts in a congressional contest. Yeah. So,
Jay, I know we're running a little bit long, but I was wondering if, given the magnitude of what Russian dictator Vladimir Putin has said this last week, I was thinking maybe we could end talking about that story today, because I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, the greater potential for nuclear Armageddon or something like that, to end on a high note.
You hate to miss that story.
Yeah, no, it really would be kind of the, bearing the lead, sort of thing.
We talked about Donald Trump being prosecuted for real estate and fraud and missed the nuclear war.
Yeah, that would not be good for us.
So as Mike alluded to, this week, Russian dictator Vladimir Putin has called up some 300,000 Russian reservists to aid in his invasion of the Ukraine. He also made a speech indicating that if Ukraine threatened the territorial sovereignty of the Russian Republic, as he calls it, and nothing is off the table, and nuclear weapons are possible, and he's not kidding. This is not a bluff. Consonant with that, he had arranged sort of fake elections in some of these Russian occupied areas of Ukraine to claim that they are now Russian territory. So this is something that people early in the war had speculated on, right? That if it starts going terribly badly for Putin, because he has put his entire his entire dictatorship on the line here, right? If he's pushed into a corner, you know, this might be the only way out for him and so forth. And, you know, shouldn't we have an off ramp and all that kind of thing? And it was sort of, you know, dismissed as well. But yeah, but it's not really going to happen because the Russians are going to just wipe out the Ukraine in a couple weeks, in a couple weeks. And of course, that didn't happen. And the tide has turned and you actually have Ukrainian advances retaking places that the Russians had taken. So, Mike, I'll go to you here on the again, as two Cold War kids who grew up under the shadow of nuclear annihilation. But you can lead off.
Well, I think number one that like a lot of folks, I don't think that you know 300,000 whatever reservist call up or mobilization is going to make much of a difference. You're just even more poorly trained and motivated troops to add to the already very right. poorly trained. But and so I think that's just to kind of sort of stop the bleeding. And that's of course going to take months for those troops to come online and make any appreciable difference. So it seems to me that that's the lesser part of that, though, that raises some internal concerns for Putin, though I think he can probably handle those reasonably well. To me, it seems from everything that I've been hearing and thinking about that, well, we're in a situation where, like you said, that this isn't the sort of situation where Putin can back off. In fact, he's doubled down on this with these elections and the whole gambit, right, of saying that, well, we are going to have these elections and they will, of course, be, you know, great majorities to say these are now Russian territories and therefore any attack on them is an attack on Russian territory. Yep. And we will. And from what we've been hearing, at least publicly, that the NATO, the Western response to a Russian nuclear attack, and it would almost certainly be a small, quote unquote, small, like
yeah, one tactical nuke,
one kiloton kind of tactical sort of nuke. And to give a sense, kind of the biggest conventional weapons that we've seen are these called thermobaric devices or fuel air devices. They're roughly like 2/5 of a kiloton, something like that. The smallest tactical nukes are around 1 kiloton. So there's a pretty big difference, but the real difference isn't an explosive ability. The real difference is in that crossing that line that hasn't been crossed since, of course, the U.S. dropped those two nukes on Japan. And it seems to me that what we've been hearing is the Western response is, well, hey, if you do this, there are going to be sanctions. And well, you know, I said, okay.
No more McDonald's for you. Yes.
It seems pretty clear that obviously we do not want to get into nuclear escalation. And so the way I see this, and I think the way probably Putin sees this is he would prefer to not use a nuclear weapon for obvious reasons. Because there will be consequences and it will estrange him more from his key allies, right? Particularly China.
Well, you lose the Chinese at that point. Yeah.
But I think that if it's a question of that or losing the war, I think I know which way he's going to come down. And again, assuming that what we've been hearing publicly is some sort of a reasonable approximation of how the West would respond, how the U.S. would respond, if I'm Putin, I say, well, push comes to shove, then yeah, I will go ahead and launch a tactical nuke against some Ukrainian position, an arms depot, and probably not a city at first, and just hope that will get the Ukrainians to basically come to the negotiating table and say, okay, you can have these four regions because, you know, because the West is not going to respond with force to a nuclear attack, or at least a limited nuclear attack. That to me is what I'm hearing, and I get that. But I think that's been the problem from the beginning. In this game of chicken, it's clear to me that Vladimir Putin has a lot more to lose, and he is not going to be the first one to blink. That's why I think that what we're going to see at some point in 2023 is either kind of a recognition that these four territories here on that eastern edge of Ukraine are de facto Russian territories, granted with a lot of fighting within those territories, or there is going to be a nuclear launch, a tactical nuclear launch by Russia. I expect one of those two things to happen.
Wow. All right, that's a big prediction.
Yeah, I noticed.
I'm a little more I guess optimistic. I think Putin is evil, craven, and all that, but I don't think he's nuts. And I think that the fallout, the making Russia such the international pariah that it would be if it launched a first strike nuclear weapons, is something that he does not want. And I think he realizes he can say, well, geez, I won the war. But I think even then, taking that action, I think could threaten his internal stability.
See, right?
There's protests that are you know, as increasing throughout Russia with the call up. I think there is somebody who is probably not necessarily a nice guy or anything, but equally calculating, maybe waiting in the wings, right? There have been a lot of in the last couple of weeks, Putin allies who just tend to stumble off balconies and having all kinds of accidents,
falling down multiple flights of stairs with injuries.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just been, it's been that kind of week, for Putin, allies. So I think, he is perhaps sensing some internal pressure, which could account for some of these accidents, that his former buddies are having. So I think that would just really exacerbate it if he wants a nuclear weapon, and the you would even have, again, the Chinese, I think, would have to step aside and say, well, you know, we're.
But see, that I agree, but I think the
North Koreans would still be with you, right?
Yeah.
Still
have, but I think the Chinese
I assume the Iranians, but
I think the Chinese thing would be temporary. I think if they I think they would certainly say that, you know, would be against that sort of thing. But I think Putin would gamble to say, well, you know what, wait a year or so and we can wait this out. And they're actually, you know, they're in kind of a weird position because they like to see the West weakened as well. And so there's no better balm for sort of internal difficulties than winning a war. And this might do it. And so I think this is going to be a calculated risk he's taking, but given the amount of control he has over this country, like no Soviet Union leader ever had. I mean, you have to go back to the czars to find somebody who's had this kind of one person.
Stalin had a good deal of control.
But even Stalin had other folks who were kind of up in there. And so I think I hope you're right, certainly, about this. But I think in 2023, I think it's going to take a little while because he's going to wait and sort of see. Might even come before that, but I expect probably not. But sometime in the near future, within the next 6 months, we're either going to see this sort of de facto recognition that, yes, these four provinces are, for better or worse, Russian territory, and there's going to be guerrilla fighting and all that there, you know, like in.
I think that could happen, right? I think there's a possibility that the West could start, you know, giving hints and offering that sort of off ramp, right? Excuse me. Where an avenue to negotiation that, you know, Putin gets to keep these couple territories and so forth. And we have a ceasefire there. Now, can the Ukrainians agree to that? Yes and no. They would say no. But of course, if we're providing all the weapons to fight the war,
we
get to call the tune.
And that's the point of a nuclear strike, is all of a sudden we say, well, my gosh, we don't want to escalate this anymore. And clearly he's willing to do this. And so therefore we are going to back off on our support unless you come to the negotiating table and for the good of the world, basically, to give up the eastern part of your country so that there's not a nuclear war. And I think that's...
I see it the other way around a little bit. I mean, I think he has more leverage for negotiation before a nuclear strike than after. I think once you've dropped the bomb, there's nothing left to do.
Well, I think
that would tend to just galvanize the West and the rest of the world against him and potentially against China.
I hope you're right. I think it might be the
other
way.
The Chinese
around.
Were like, "Hey, we've been thinking about invading somebody." And you know, we don't want everybody to get all anti-invasion now.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a plausible scenario, and it's certainly a more optimistic scenario than the one I have. Yeah, that the one I'm envisioning, and so I hope that's correct. But I don't feel that that's how it's going to play out. But again, I didn't feel like we would see the amount of support and the sort of situation we have in Ukraine now, which is, you know, very positive from all things considered, right? So I was wrong about that. Almost everyone was wrong about that. But I think in the face of a limited nuclear strike, even if it's just a nuclear launch over an unoccupied area, I think that the West is just going to say, whoa, wait a second and just back off, because no one wants to be the person who instigated or kind of egged on in any way a war that could kill, you know, hundreds of millions of people. And so that's how I think it's going to go. But again, let's just all hope that you're right on this one, as I know you, you know, he's like to say a lot of things. But all right, well, I think that pretty much does it for us for this episode. We went a little bit long here, though. I should point out that before we do go, if you're a regular listener, you know already what a big fan I am of When the People Decide, the podcast that takes a deep dive into citizen initiatives, democracy at its purest or at its worst, depending on how you see things, I would guess. But every one of the 10 episodes from this season, as far as I'm concerned, absolutely worth my time. And that's exactly what I would expect from Jenna and everyone else there at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. They're the ones who are behind When the People Decide. You know, I was going to say, don't take my word for it, but, you know, do take my word for it. But kind of going back to Cold War stuff, Jay, trust but verify. So, you know,
yes.
Yeah, check out When the People Decide, and you will see that I am absolutely right here. I am confident. And you can find When the People Decide on whatever app you use to listen to Politics Guys. You can also go to democracygroup.org/shows, and that will take you not only to When the People Decide, but all the other most excellent podcasts in the Democracy Group network. All right, so I said that does it for us for this week. And if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, we hope you will consider becoming one, because, hey, if you're a supporter, in a few days, you will be getting our midweek show. Jay and I are going to be getting ready to record that in just a bit. We have all kinds of
interesting. It's going to be really good.
It's going to be spectacular. You know, we're going to be talking about a lot of interesting stuff, as we always do. But, you know, and without our supporters, we just couldn't keep the show going. And you get ad-free versions of everything we put out, as well as that midweek show, other stuff as well. And so to check it all out, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. And all the support links are on the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And we always want to make sure that if you want all of our content, but you're not in a position to financially support the show, that that's not a barrier. So if that's you, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get it set up so that you can get that midweek bonus show. And whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, review us on whatever podcast app you use, as well as to share episodes on social media. And finally, a special thanks to our most excellent, our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you join us.